26581.
Group Captain Eccles, Reel 7. We were talking about when you went out to join to the number one school of general reconnaissance at George, South Africa, as a flight lieutenant. Now, you were to be an instructor. Now, perhaps it was a ground instructor. Was it a flying instructor you didn't want to be, or was it just the fact it was in England as an instructor? What was behind it?
I just was not temperamentally the right kind of person to pass on information on how to fly an aircraft.
Why not, do you think?
I don't know, because I was very happy. In fact, these various aircraft I've talked about that we had at St. Neville to try out, no one ever gave me any instruction on how to fly them. They just turned up and I had to go and fly them, and I got quite used to the idea of getting in an aircraft, a strange aircraft, and flying it. I think probably the reason I didn't look forward to the idea of being a flying instructor was that it was all too formal, and one had to carry on doing routine activities and teaching pupils certain things, and not being able to do things your own way.
Now here, though, you were a ground instructor. Now tell me what you were instructed in.
I was instructing in codes and ciphers as part of the general reconnaissance course, which was teaching the students on the various codes that we used in Coastal Command and the Psycho machine, S-Y-K-O machine, that was used for coding signals before being sent by WT from aircraft.
Now, I think the Psycho machine is new. I think we talked a bit about the codes and ciphers last time.
Yes. I mentioned the Psycho, didn't I, in the U-boat?
You did, yeah,
yes.
Not quite really how it worked.
It's a bit tricky to describe, actually, and it might take too much time to be bothered about.
Okay, right, fair enough. So you were what about you were enjoying this work?
Oh yes, I mean, South Africa, of course, was wonderful. The climate, there was no food rationing, luxury living. Although, in fact, the day I arrived in George, it snowed, and there. As far as I know, they had never had snow before, and there was no heating available. It was bitterly cold, but that only lasted for a day or two. In fact, just about the time the weather improved, the Governor General in South Africa died, and I had to go up and attend his funeral at Pretoria. The ground instruction work I quite enjoyed. But strangely enough, after a very short time, I was posted to the Central Examinations Board at Headquarters 25 Group in Port Elizabeth to be an examiner. And this was an interesting job. I was billeted in the Elizabeth Hotel and lived a very luxurious life. I was the only officer billeted in the hotel, which was essentially a tourist place. And the work at the examinations board was interesting, setting questions for students of the air navigation schools in South Africa, and then marking them and so on. One of the...
And you were examining in the subject of operational reconnaissance?
Yes. And I can remember an interesting case in which... a number of officers of the Greek Air Force had been able to escape and join the Royal Air Force, and although they were qualified, they had to go through the RAF training scheme. Their knowledge of English was extremely limited, and one of the papers I received, one of the answers papers I received, had a lot of the writing actually in Greek. And the English was little bits and pieces of words, but it was very hard to understand what it was all about. In answering the questions, the students had to give certain diagrams which were based on instructional manuals they had. And in the end, I decided that if they had the right drawings there, they were good enough, so I passed them. I couldn't see any purpose in failing them. And after all, it was wartime.
And how did you get on with the South Africans?
Life in the social life in Port Elizabeth was amazing. All the young men of South Africa were up north fighting, and there were no young men left behind. So I found myself in Port Elizabeth as a young officer, being invited by people I'd never met or knew anything about to go to parties. I would get a telephone call in the office, "You don't know me, I don't know you, but would you like to come to a party this evening?" It was a round of festivities. It was a real escape from the war.
Were you aware of the problems in South African society, or did you see them as problems, you know?
Oh, I was aware of the problems of South African society, but only sort of in an indirect way. You've got to remember in those days that the British Empire was the British Empire, and that racism as such was not a matter that was considered. It was everyone, if you like, was a racist, and it never caused any problems. The only problem in South Africa was of a political nature, where there was a group of activists who were pro-Nazi who would attempt to cause a certain amount of trouble. I can remember when I was at George going to the cinema, to the local cinema, and we used to, at the end of the performance, the national anthem would be played and everyone would stand up. The OBs, who were these neo-Nazi people, would not stand up and they would cause trouble. So we always sat ourselves at the end of each row and stood up and refused to let the other members who were sitting inside move until the national anthem was over. That's about all I can remember of any incidents of any sort in South Africa.
Now, you were there doing this examination job. You seem to have passed most people from the sound of it. Would that be fair to say?
Sorry,
you seem to have passed most people.
I can't remember what the pass rate was. These were just exceptions because they were Greek. I mean, the majority of the students were, of course, English-speaking students. They were.
So you wouldn't make allowances for them?
This was part of the MPRS training scheme, in which the old empire was used very much for dispersing flying training activities away from the centre of military operations. And so our students came mostly from the UK, but also from other parts of the empire.
Now you did this until February 44.
Yes, I was able, having got married in South Africa, my wife having been posted to India and moved on to India, I was able to persuade the powers that be to give me a compassionate posting to India to join my wife, which came through. And I arrived in Bombay in early of 44. My wife was in Burma. The communications between us were to start with, extremely poor. I was sending signals through to her, but her replies were not coming through to me. However, an RAF colleague of hers in Camilla soon put an answer to this problem by sending a telegram, a signal to me, which was for the attention of Flight Lieutenant Eccles from the Commander-in-Chief, 3rd Tactical Air Force. And that came through. And from then on, we were in communication. I was, because of my previous Met Flights experience, posted to the Met Flight at Calcutta, which was some 200 or 300 miles away from my wife, but at least it was a lot closer than Bombay.
Is this Alipur? Is Alipur Calcutta's airport?
Yes.
And it wasn't just the Met Flight, was it? You seem to have been in charge of
two... I'll get on to this
now. Oh, sorry, right.
When I arrived in Calcutta, I discovered that a slightly unusual organisation in the sense that there was no station headquarters at the airfield, but instead there was a wing headquarters it wasn't a wing headquarters, it was a station headquarters in Calcutta. And it was there I reported. And the station commander said, well, look, whilst you're taking over this Met flight at Aleppo, he said, there's a calibration flight at Aleppo that doesn't have a commanding officer, so take that over as well. So I found myself in possibly a unique position of being a commanding officer of two different autonomous units at the same time. In fact, later on, one of the units was moved to another airfield. So I was commanding two units on two different airfields at the same time. But at least I was my own boss.
No, I mean, one of these was a 1300 Met flight. Was this what was this flying?
Well, both the Met flight and the calibration flight were operating Blenheim 5 Bisley aircraft.
And we haven't mentioned them before, I don't think. What did you think of them, the Blenheim
5? Well, once again, this was an aircraft that I just had to get in and fly. There was no one around to teach me to fly them. The Blenheim was a pre-war aircraft which didn't measure up to frontline activities. And in fact, by the time I took over the Met flight in Calcutta, we were the last unit operating Blenheims in India. In fact, so much so that whenever we wanted any spares, like a spare engine, we were simply sent another aircraft. So that in the end, having an official establishment of something like six aircraft for the two units, I finished up with 12. And when one unit was posted to this other airfield at Bagachi, which was, I can't remember now, 40, 50 miles away, I decided that I'd get some volunteers from other units to come and fly some of the aircraft, and we do a formation flypast over Calcutta. So we had some 12 Blenheims that we took off to go to Bagachi. Unknown to us, at the time we were taxiing out to the runway at Aleppo, Lord Leo Mountbatten was standing on a soapbox giving a pep talk to the air crews of the night fighter squadron, the night fighter bow fighter squadron that was based at Aleppo. And as we taxied past, he had to stop speaking. And so as 12 aircraft went past, he had to wait quite a long time. And eventually, after we'd all lined up and taken off, he resumed his talk by saying, I hope most of them come back. Little did he know that we were not on an operational flight. The units, the Blenheims, the two units were eventually re-equipped. One with Vengeance aircraft, that was the calibration flight, and the other with Hurricane aircraft, that was the Met flight. So two more aircraft I had to fly without any instruction. In fact, the Vengeance was my first flight. The Vengeance was quite interesting. I was by this time based at Bagachi.
How do you spell that?
Baigachi.
And that was with the 1300 had gone there, had they?
Both the calibration, eventually, you see, they both calibration and the radar, and the both flights went there.
Okay, right.
It was just that one went before the other, and that's why they're on two airfields, different airfields at the same time. But they both finished up there.
So you were saying about this flight in the
Yeah, well, owing to a lack of communication, the people responsible for delivering the first Vengeance aircraft, when we were re-equipped, delivered it to Aleppo. And flying control at Aleppo rang me up to say, would I come and pick up the aircraft that had been delivered? So I went over to Aleppo to pick it up. I'd never seen a Vengeance before and didn't know the first thing about them. They were, in fact, just about the biggest single-engine aircraft ever built by the Americans. I didn't have any handbook to look at, but somebody had told me that you had to have flap on takeoff or you'd never get airborne. And that was the only information I had. As I got into this aircraft, I put on the necessary flap for takeoff and discovered two things. First of all, the rev counter on this aeroplane was a very simple single dial affair that went all the way around, and it wasn't all that easy to read straight off as to whether you were getting a 2,000 or 2,200 revs on it, or whatever. The other thing was that being an American aircraft, on takeoff, the engine turned the opposite way to an RAF aircraft, and it swung the opposite way. And I wasn't actually thinking about this as I took off. And as I was going down the runway, I didn't appear to be gaining a sufficient speed to get airborne. And I was looking down at the instruments to see what revs I was getting and trying to work it out. And when I looked up again, I'd swung off the runway and was going across the grass, which was crisscrossed with monsoon ditches, and heading straight for a copse of wood. So as I approached the copse of wood, I decided the only thing to do was to pull back on the stick and climb, and the aircraft went up like a rocket. What I didn't know was also that the aircraft had a negative angle of incidence that meant that when it was flying straight and level, it was actually flying tail down. And so although I was in the tail down position on the runway, I actually did have plenty of flying speed. The reason for it being tail down was that the aircraft had been built as a dive bomber, and the negative angle of incidence gave you the ability to dive the aircraft vertically, which from a dive bombing point of view was very good. The arrival at Bagachi was without incident.
When you got used to it, what did you think of the Vengeance?
Well, the Vengeance was a typical, comfortable American aeroplane. It had its quirks. One of them was that the fuel tanks consisted of little fuel tanks fitted in the wings in whatever little areas there were. So altogether, there must have been a dozen or more fuel tanks in the aircraft, with a dozen or more switches to switch the electric pumps from one fuel tank to another. So there was a battery of switches in front of you, and the one fuel contents gauge, which simply gave you the contents of that particular tank that you were switched onto. The gauge itself was a bit vague in the sense that it said quarter, half, three quarters and full. And as each tank was of a different capacity, this was a bit tricky to know where you stood. It was also necessary to fly, to use them in a strict rotation to keep the aircraft within its limits of centre of gravity. But apart from that, it was a delightful aeroplane.
I mean, how did it compare to the Blenheim, for instance, or the Hudson?
Well, compared from a flying point of view, it was far superior to the Blenheim. British aircraft were always the sort of aircraft that when you were getting in and out, you tore your clothing, you caught your thumb on things, you scraped your skin. They were never all that easy. That never happened to the American aircraft. They were much more comfortable. And the Vengeance was in that category. The Hurricane, which I had to fly, and again without instruction.
That was the one that the radar calibration people had, was it?
No,
the
wrong way around. The Vengeance was for radar calibration. And so it was a two-seat aircraft, the Vengeance, and they met the calibration chap was in the back. The Hurricanes, of course, we were just single-seater by this time, and they were to do the vertical climb over Calcutta, and I carried out the first met ascent. It was by no means as comprehensive as we'd been used to before, because there was no strut psychrometer. All we were doing really was reporting barometric pressure. Again, a thing we did, in fact we devised it with the Blenheims. Our communications with the group headquarters in Calcutta, landline communications, were very poor indeed. We were not airborne long enough to transmit by radio our weather reports. So we came to a system whereby the information that had been recorded by the observer was put in a small bag with lead weights, and we flew low over the headquarters and dropped the result in their grounds. And that gave them a much quicker answer to the weather situation. The Vengeance aircraft were soon after, in fact, we re-equipped, I was posted from the net flight.
Can I just, before we go on, can I just ask about the ground radar calibration flight, what they were actually doing? I know it says what they were doing, but I don't quite understand what it was.
Well, the purpose of the radar calibration flight was, as its title suggests, to calibrate ground radar. And the aircraft carried a small bit of radio equipment, which transmitted signals, and you went to agreed positions beforehand and transmitted from them, and then they were able to check that their equipment was giving the right distance and bearing. And we did this for the different ground radar stations in the area.
Right. Anything else happened while you were with these flights? You were out there, it looks, till about September 44, from the looks of things, from February 44.
Well, actually, there were various things that happened of an anecdotal nature.
Oh, yeah.
I used to fly over in a Hurricane, or in fact, whatever aircraft was available, to visit my wife in Camilla, or she was just outside Camilla, at a place called Minor Natty, about once or twice a month at weekends, spend a night there. And the airfield I used was a strip. It wasn't really an airfield, it was just a strip of grass strip. And there was somebody in a caravan giving you a green light to land, but apart from that, there was virtually no control at all. And it was a very much used strip by all kinds of visiting aircraft. In fact, there was also voice communication, but the green light was the essential thing. And on one occasion, I can remember the man on the ground was so frustrated with the enormous amount of traffic that when I asked for landing instructions, he told me I was number 75 to land. But in fact, it was a bit like musical chairs. You went round and round in a circuit, and when you got to the beginning of the runway, if it looked clear, you went into land. And if he didn't give you a red light, you just carried on. And eventually, at the far end of the grass strip, would be a collection of aircraft waiting for someone to have the courage to start taxiing back down the strip to the space in the middle where there was parking room. It was interesting because the way of life during the war, and particularly out in India, was not exactly strictly disciplined. In fact, so much so that when we re-equipped the Blenheims, nobody wanted our Blenheims. They didn't give us any proper disposal instructions. So I took a Blenheim for myself, and I had all the turrets and guns and armour plate taken out, and had all the camouflage paint stripped off, and had this beautiful silver Blenheim as my own personal aircraft.
And you'd use it to fly?
I'll tell you about that when I'm posted.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that came with you from then on?
Well, I'll tell you. When I'm posted to the next unit, I'll tell you about it.
What about conditions of life in India? I mean, you know, are both Alipur and Bengaji?
Conditions of life were very much dominated by things like malaria, dengue, and so on. In fact, so much so that becoming anti-malarial, which meant wearing long trousers with your socks outside your trousers and your long sleeves buttoned down to the wrist, if you weren't like that by dusk, it was a court-martial offence. Because the vast majority of patients in the hospitals were suffering from medical conditions and not injuries.
What other precautions were taken against malaria or any of the other diseases?
None at all.
You weren't taking quinine?
No. In those days, there were no antibiotics and there was no... There was nothing.
Or mepocrine?
No, you got that when you were in hospital, when you got malaria.
And what about, what are the diseases? You mentioned dengue and, I don't know, dysentery, things like that. Was malaria the main worry?
Well, There are two different stories here. As far as I was concerned, at Bagachi, we didn't have any immediate health problems. I got dengue and so on, and people got malaria. But my wife in Camilla was a quite a different story, with the smallpox and cholera and dysentery and God knows what. The 14th Army in Burma had a terrible time from the point of view of health.
Now, what about the sort of conditions under which you lived, in the sense of your accommodation and food and Indian servants, that kind of thing? Start with the accommodation.
The accommodation in when I was at Alipore was that we occupied a block of flats in Park Street, Calcutta. And it was quite civilised, and the food was quite good, and the service was quite good. When we went to Bagachi, we found ourselves in a wooden hutted establishment, a wooden mess, and a little wooden chalets, really just sort of one per officer. They were just huts, really. And of course, we had to sleep inside mosquito nets. And there was no electricity in the place. We had hurricane lamps to carry around. There was lighting. There was electric lighting in the mess, but not in the huts. From the staff point of view, you had the first thing you did when you arrived in India, or at least on where you posted to, was to get a bearer. And a bearer was simply a young person you took off the streets to be your personal servant. And I, when I arrived at Park Street, Calcutta, was told that if I went out onto the footpath, I'd see a group of people standing around and ask one of them if he could speak English and if he wanted to be my bearer. And I found this was no problem. In fact, I was besieged by people wanting to be my bearer, and I picked out Tommy, who stayed with me for quite a long time and was extremely loyal and honest, and I couldn't have had I don't suppose he was more than about 18, I couldn't have had any better service.
And what did he do for you? What was his role?
His role was to give me personal service. He would wake me up in the morning with a cup of tea, he would see to all my laundry and that everything was clean and tidy. He'd lay out clothes for me, he'd have the bed made for me. When I was eating in the mess, he would serve me in the mess, and of course other people the same, so the mess would be full of bearers who would be standing more or less behind the officer they worked for at his beck and call. And the way of life in India was such that you couldn't possibly exist without a bearer. The life in Calcutta was interesting in the sense that one of the officers on my unit had been a tea taster. He was, like myself, a youngster, but he had been a tea taster in Calcutta before the war and had lived there and therefore knew his way around. And he had his bearer had been with him for quite a long time. And on one occasion, he used to treat his bearer, I suppose in retrospect, in a rather brutal way. If his bearer misbehaved and didn't do what he was expected to do, and committed an offence, he would be fined, maybe a rupee. And when he was fined a rupee, this chap would take a rupee note out of his wallet and tear it up in front of the bearer and say, "There, you'll find one rupee," so that nobody actually benefited from it. And I can well remember on one occasion we had been invited to a cocktail party at Ballygunge, a few miles out of Park Street, on the end of the tram line. And our two bearers were to be at this place with our change of clothing when we arrived at whatever it was, 5 o'clock. And when we arrived there, this other fellow's bearer hadn't got a clean shirt for him. So this officer said to him, "Look, you've got half an hour to produce a shirt for me." And how this bearer got back the 4 or 5 miles to Park Street and got his shirt and was back again in half an hour, I have no idea. No questions were ever asked, but the shirt was produced.